This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Later in the hour, a medical historian breaks down the gurgling, growling history of the gut and how our understanding of it has evolved over time. Plus, a newly discovered fossil could help us understand how bird brains evolved. But first, the UN's International Climate Conference, known as COP29, got underway this week in Azerbaijan. We've talked about this conference on the show before, where leaders from around the world come together to find ways to lower emissions and coordinate financial efforts. And a big focus this year was to negotiate a deal for wealthier countries to financially compensate developing nations who've gone through climate change-related damage. The only problem is that world leaders from the top polluting countries like the U.S. and China aren't showing up. Here to explain more and give us an update on other science stories from this week is Umair Irfan, senior correspondent at Vox, based in Washington, D.C. Welcome back, Umair.
Hey, Ira. Thanks for having me back.
So what's going on with COP29 this year? Why aren't the U.S. and China in the room where it happens?
Well, as you noted, it is getting off to a subdued start. Part of it is just that I think expectations are a bit lower for this conference, that while others had really high agenda items, this one does seem to be a little bit more in the weeds. But there are also a whole lot of other world events going on that other leaders are distracted by. Next week, the G20 summit, where the top 20 largest economies in the world are supposed to meet in Brazil. And so many world leaders have decided to prioritize that. The United States, as you may recall, just also went through a presidential election where we're likely to see some big changes in our international climate policy. And so this has been something of a lower profile event for a lot of diplomats.
Yeah. Can you remind us of the types of deals made at past conferences?
Right. Well, this is where, as you noted, where countries kind of hash out the details of their plans to address climate change. So like the big things were laying out commitments, that basically going out and publicly putting a stake down and saying that this is exactly what we plan to do to mitigate climate change. Here's how we plan to do it. Here's how much we're going to invest. And that sort of creates this sort of public accountability measure. And then from there, what countries also do is come up with ways with how they're going to pay for it, pay for their own mitigation measures, but also to help the countries that contributed the least to climate change, the ones who are the low emitters, but are also already facing the effects of rising temperatures, sea level rise, and so on. This latter part, the money aspect of it, has always been a really thorny discussion topic. And this year, at this year's COP, they struggled just to get the agenda agreed to because they were going to talk so much about money. And they finally got that through, but it's likely to be something that they're going to be arguing about for much of the conference as it stretches through next week.
Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to space news. Something really cool. Scientists learned that we probably got an inaccurate picture of Uranus when Voyager 2 flew past it in 1986. What's that about?
Right. When Voyager 2 was passing the planet, it got a really strange snapshot of the planet. It noticed that the protective magnetic field around Uranus was actually devoid of plasma and was much smaller than it was expected to be when it's found around other planets. And so scientists for a long time were very puzzled by this, that what is it about Uranus that leads to these strange electromagnetic phenomena that's different from other planets? But this week, scientists released a study that found that we actually caught the planet with Voyager 2 at a very unique time in its history. And it was during what they said was a big increase in solar activity. The planet was actually at that moment getting walloped by a wind from the sun, basically a phenomenon what's called a co-rotating interaction region. This plasma from the sun, this burst of activity, was sweeping out into space, and it was hammering the magnetosphere around Uranus. And that led to the depletion of plasma around the planet. And it was pretty surprising, like that scientists had not considered that this mechanism was at work before.
Yeah, so I guess next time we do a quick flyby of a planet, they're going to have to pay a little more attention to what the sun's doing at that time.
Exactly. Yes, NASA is planning to launch another spacecraft in 2032 towards Uranus. And also, as they study other planets, they're going to have to keep in mind that anytime they take a snapshot, that it's just a snapshot in time, and that planets can actually undergo some pretty big changes very quickly.
Yeah, that's what science is all about, isn't it?
Yeah, learning the hard way.
Yeah, that snapshot in time. Okay, next we've got a bit of a worrying statistic, and I mean alcohol consumption is up this year. It seems like that side effect from COVID is still sticking around, perhaps?
That does seem to be the case, that, you know, in the United States, we saw a fairly moderate decline in alcohol consumption throughout much of the 20th century. Then we saw a slight uptick starting to begin in the 90s. And then at the start of COVID, there was a pretty big spike in alcohol consumption. The rate of alcohol-related deaths in 2020 had risen almost 25% compared to the year before. That's for what scientists think is for a lot of the obvious reasons. People were cooped up at home, people had lost their jobs, and people were just drinking to cope with the stress. But since a lot of the pandemic restrictions have lifted, that high level of alcohol consumption has remained and has, in fact, continued to climb upwards. We've seen in past periods of intense stress, like after 9/11 or after hurricanes like Katrina, we saw alcohol consumption go up and then go back down. But the sustained level of high consumption here is a bit worrying, and scientists are trying to kind of tease apart why. One idea is that alcohol is, in fact, addictive, that high levels of consumption can lead to persistent levels of consumption. But there may be other factors as well, that like things like access to behavioral health services may have gone down during the pandemic and may never have been restored. And so a lot of people who are trying to curb their own alcohol use have not found the resources that they need to be able to do so.
Gotcha. For our next story, a team of scientists found amber in one of my favorite places, Antarctica. It seems like the last place you'd find amber, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, typically when we study the past in Antarctica, scientists look at ice cores and they look at sediment samples. But while looking at a sediment core, they found about 3,000 feet below the Amundsen Sea in West Antarctica, they found a chunk of amber. And amber is a really interesting way to get a snapshot into the past, because not only does it trap air and particles, it tends to trap pieces of living organisms and sometimes even entire living organisms. So it gives you a really interesting window into what was alive during that period of time. Now, this chunk of amber was dated to roughly 90 million years ago. So this is during the Cretaceous period. So this is when dinosaurs were on the Earth, but also when the continents were in slightly different positions. Parts of Antarctica were further north. But that doesn't necessarily explain why there were trees there on their own. Now, we do see evidence that Antarctica had forests before, but it was also still very far south. And what scientists theorize is that part of the mechanism here is that the forests actually help the continent absorb more heat. You know, ice tends to reflect sunlight back into space and keep things cool. But this layer of forest cover actually kind of reversed that trend and helped generate its own ecosystem that kept it viable for forest growth.
Wow, that is interesting. I remember when they found coal in Antarctica a while back.
Yeah, it turns out that it was like a lot more biologically productive than it looks right now and may have looked very different. It wasn't always this frozen, you know, landscape that we see today.
Continental drift. All right, sticking with some cool nature finds, it looks like the world's largest organism might also be its oldest. How big? How old are we talking about here?
Right. This is an organism called Pando. It is a quaking aspen. This is actually not a tree, but a system of trees that are genetically identical. It spans more than 100 acres in Utah. It reproduces through cloning itself. And while at the surface, it looks like 47,000 distinct trees, below the ground, it's actually interconnected. And for a long time, scientists have said that this is basically considered to be the world's largest organism. It's also the heaviest. And now they have evidence that it's also the oldest. Because it reproduces by making shoots of itself, looking at the tree rings themselves doesn't tell the whole story, because some of those trees are going to be much younger, some are going to be much older. And so what scientists did was they investigated a lake bed near Pando, and they found pollen there in the soil sediment samples and looked at samples going back up to 60,000 years. And they found that Pando might actually be about 16,000 years old, basically around the end of the last ice age when glaciers began to retreat in that area.
Wow. So it's not like if you go there, you see sort of a forest, but they're all connected underground through some sort of root system, or it's one big thing.
Yeah, exactly. And part of what's remarkable here is that these trees are genetically identical. And so for 16,000 years, this organism has been able to reproduce and send its trees up without making very many mistakes in doing so. Wow. That like having being alive and like being able to make that many copies of yourself and do so very close to perfectly is something pretty remarkable that like, you know, we struggle to do that as humans. Like, you know, that's part of why we get cancer. So figuring out how this organism was able to preserve its genome for such a long right. time could yield some really important findings that could benefit us.
All right, let's wrap this up. But with this story, there's a new genetic test that could help detect some hard-to-diagnose infections. Tell us about that.
Right. Researchers at the University of California, San Francisco this week put out a couple studies looking at ways that they could analyze DNA and RNA from patients and try to figure out what is causing diseases. You know, the traditional way that we diagnose infections is by looking at proteins and other related substances that are produced by infections or by our immune system's response to them. But sometimes when you do those tests, like they come up blank and it's hard to diagnose exactly what is causing that problem. And so scientists theorize that, you know, what if you could just take a sample of biofluids and just try to analyze every bit of genetic material that's in there. And they found out that, yeah, that's actually something that's useful. They were able to, looking at spinal fluid, able to diagnose 86% of neurological infections in a samples that they gathered over a 7-year period, looking at about 4,800 samples. And they also found that by looking at the genetic material, they could also figure out when there's a new pathogen that potentially even detect new viruses when they see some genetic material that doesn't line up with anything in their databases. This is obviously going to be a very slow, expensive way to run a test, and so probably not going to be a frontline diagnostic. But when it comes to really hard to treat cases or when other infections have got doctors stumped, this could be a very useful backstop.
Cool. Cool stuff as always, Umair. Thank you for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me, Ira.
Umair Irfan, senior correspondent at Vox, based in Washington, D.C. We have to take a break, and when we come back, we'll figure out why it's been so hard to study the gut and how all its nerves make it act like a second brain. Yeah, stick with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Plato. When people get together and talk about their aches and pains, I have found that chances are the talk turns to tummy. The stomach remains a subject of mystery and intrigue. After all, it's nearly impossible to ignore its gurgles and growls, right? And if you're a frequent listener to this show, you're familiar with our fascination with the gut's microbiome, the constellation of trillions of microbes thriving in our bodies, and that our stomachs have some of the same neuroreceptors as our brains, sort of a second brain, so to speak. You know, that gut feeling? Well, my next guest has traced the changing cultural and scientific understanding of the gut. Dr. Elsa Richardson is author of Rumbles, The Curious History of the Gut. She's the co-director of the Center for the Social History of Health and Healthcare at Strathclyde University, based in Glasgow, Scotland. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks so much for having me on, Ira.
In the book, you write about not just the medical history of the gut, also its cultural history. How have the metaphors we use to describe the gut shaped our understanding of it?
Well, I think that's what really got me interested in the gut as a topic. So I'm a medical historian by training, but my interest tends to lie in where medicine and ideas about health sit in culture. And what I noticed when I was looking into the history of digestion and looking into the history of diet was how dramatically the metaphors we have used to describe, think about our stomachs have changed over time. So my area of specialism is the 19th century British history. And one thing that I found really odd in a way was the way that the metaphors then that attached themselves to the stomach were overwhelmingly negative. So I think today we tend to talk about our stomachs as, you know, these kind of beautiful blooming gardens that have to be, you know, tended and carefully managed, you know, ecosystems within, maybe. Whereas in the 19th century, the metaphors and the language associated with the gut was much more confrontational. So, you know, you have physicians in the middle of the century describing the gut as an enemy within, as a foe that had to be conquered, or this kind of irascible creature that lived within you, which, you know, you fed and you tried to placate, and yet it still acted against you. You still gave you stomach aches and terrible pains. Many of the sources that I was looking at and citing were, you know, from the medical community, were physicians who were talking about and describing the stomach using really florid language, kind of quite unusual imagery.
Mm-hmm. You know, possibly some of the mystery of the gut revolves around historically, it was harder to study as compared to other body systems, right?
Yeah, I think that's part of why the metaphors around the gut are so rich and so diverse. One of the reasons is that for so long, the stomach really remained something of a kind of medical mystery. When dissection became part of medical education, these dissection manuals would often describe the need to examine the stomach first, because it's the organ which will decay quickest, right? So there's this sense in which, like, outside of the body, the stomach doesn't really make sense, or it doesn't make sense for very long. Added to that, there is, throughout medical history, especially before kind of modern medicine, the gut is also so important to treating the body, to diagnosing disease, and to managing health generally. So, you know, before we have antiseptics, before we have ways to anesthetize patients, opening up the body is a really dangerous procedure. That leads to the question of, you know, what other interventions can you make into the body? And one of the major ones is through diet, right? It's through the gut. So the gut is both a way that the body's health can be treated and maintained, but it's also kind of diagnostic space. So many doctors would examine the feces for clues as to what was going on in the interior of the body.
Yeah. And it's still talked about having a microbiome that's healthy, right? And your diet might be able to impact that.
Yeah, absolutely. So part of what is so interesting for me as a historian of medicine about the stomach and about diet is that it is an organ of the body which has resisted medical authority in interesting ways. So on the one hand, where there are other parts of the body where medical expertise is paramount, right? So you think about perhaps going to, let's say, a cardiologist, and the cardiologist tells you, listen, you know, you have to take these particular, you know, pills in order to stop yourself from having a heart attack. You would be relying on the expertise of that physician, right? And you would probably likely do what they say. However, the stomach is this space in which there is a lot of kind of competing different forms of knowledge and competing forms of expertise. So you think about the way that perhaps, you know, you may see a nutritionist if you had particular gastric problems, but you might also look to forms of household wisdom, right? You might also look to, I don't know, the advice of your grandmother about what to, you know, what's good to eat and what's not.
But we've had big advances in understanding the gut. And I'm talking about the discovery of the enteric nervous system, right? Mm-hmm. That there are all these nerves down there. How was it discovered that we have this sort of mini brain there?
Part of what is so interesting about the enteric nervous system, and so I think must have been mind-blowing to discover at the time, it's not only that there are nerves down there, but it is also that it is kind of truly, in a way, a second brain, in that what was discovered about the enteric nervous system when it was mapped by physiologists in the latter part of the 19th century was that it's also able to think for itself. The enteric nervous system can act outside of the central nervous system. So I think part of what the enteric nervous system might force us to question is exactly, you know, what kind of thinking different parts of the body are capable of doing. Because obviously the enteric nervous system and the gut don't think in the same way as the brain thinks.
Right.
But part of what this suggests is that there is a kind of cognition going on.
Yeah,
there.
Because most of us are keenly aware of the connection, I think, between the gut and the brain. You get butterflies in your stomach. Mm-hmm. You have anxiety, stomach aches, right? That relationship between mind and gut has changed over time, hasn't it? I mean, we sort of realized it, but now we know more medically, scientifically, how that happens.
I think it's absolutely changed over time. But what I find consistent through the history of the gut is that as long as we have been interested in the brain, or as long as we've been interested in the stomach, we have been convinced of a link between the two of them. So I think that, you know, modern science is doing wonderful work in terms of mapping that connection. So through the enteric nervous system, through, you know, the kind of neurons in the microbiome that you mentioned in the opening, also through the vagus nerve, that kind of direct highway between the kind of the gut and the mind. So there's a great deal of work being done just now in terms of kind of trying to understand exactly what the kind of mechanisms are which facilitate that connectivity.
Right. I know you're an historian of science, and I want to get into some history because it's fascinating. You write about a Victorian-era physician, Dr. William Arbuthnot Lane, who is obsessed with constipation and curing it. Tell me a bit about his work and his theory of the gut, and I hope I got his name right.
So William Arbuthnot Lane is a fascinating figure. So he was an extremely well-respected surgeon, working in London around the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century. He was at one point surgeon to the king. So he is a Sir William Arbuthnot Lane, actually.
Excuse me, I didn't mean to leave that out.
Excuse you.
Yes.
He becomes obsessed in the latter part of the 19th century with the problem of constipation. And one of the reasons that he becomes so interested in this problem is because of a theory that's not his theory, but which was very kind of present in this period, called the theory of auto-intoxication. And so the idea of auto-intoxication basically posits that material, waste material, sitting in the bowel for too long will begin to fester, grow putrid, and begin leaking all kinds of nasty bacteria and toxins back into the rest of the system. So this is, you know, as you can probably tell, partly a product of the rise of bacteriology as a field, right? So like this is the language of kind of good bacteria and bad bacteria. It's also a product of a generalized anxiety in the latter part of the 19th century about, you know, the problem of kind of causativeness, right? The problem of, yeah, not being able to go. And William Arbuthnot Lane suggested, or perceived, that this was in fact a much bigger problem than, you know, than physicians had previously acknowledged. And what he suggested was that all of these kind of toxins that he thought were leaking back into the body from the guts were causing all kinds of problems. So he attributed things like infertility to auto-intoxication, fatigue, muscle wastage, neurasthenia, but also, you know, quite dramatically, things like cancer. You know, the failure to empty your bowels at least once a day was something which he viewed as absolutely imperiling your health. He would advise his patients to modify their diet, to perhaps, you know, take up different forms of exercise. But in the most severe cases, he began removing clinical large sections of their colons. So either like chunks of colon, but also sometimes like full colonectomies in the most severe cases.
Wow.
And he performed hundreds of these surgeries, mainly on women, should be noted, towards the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, until finally he was pulled up in front of the British Medical Board and was eventually struck off British Medical Register. So he had this kind of quite dramatic kind of fall from grace, really, all because of this quite monomaniacal obsession with constipation.
Well, I want to get into that part you said about women. I mean, you're right about how throughout history, women have been seen as being predisposed to gut issues, right?
Yes.
Why is that?
I think it's a really complicated question. So, I mean, think about the way that even, I don't know what it's like over in the States, but in Britain, medication, laxatives, but also things like yogurts with probiotics, which are meant to improve gut health, are really predominantly marketed at women.
I didn't know that.
So we live with that association today. And apparently, you know, according to figures, women are more prone to constipation than men. Now, this may have a physiological cause, it may be that it's associated perhaps with the hormonal changes or a menstruation. However, it might also be that women today just report or more willing to admit, perhaps, to being constipated than men are. But what is interesting is that throughout history, there has been this kind of quite sustained and kind of complicated connection between women and constipation. So when William Arbuthnot Lane is working in the 19th century, he suggests that part of the problem is a kind of female prudishness around matters of the toilet. You know, that what is happening is that women have been raised in kind of stuffy Victorian households, that they are too proper, and that this is somehow kind of impeding their, you know, toileting regularity. What he also suggests, and what is consistent also throughout history, is this kind of connection that is made between women's reproductive capacity and her digestive health. So for William Arbuthnot Lane, one of the ways that he worries his female patients is by saying, look, if you are constipated, this is going to impact, one, your ability to get a husband, okay? So you will have, according to him, sallow skin and be of a kind of, you know, crabby disposition, much less likely to get wed. But also that even if you are able to, you know, somehow bag a man, you will be unable to bear children because this kind of this constipatedness in your system is going to impact your reproductive health.
I only have a few minutes left, but I don't want to let you go without talking about one of the weirdest pieces of research in your book is about how what's in your stomach relates to what we dream about. Really?
That came out of a survey which was conducted by the British Cheese Board. Boom, boom, which suggested that eating certain types of cheese before bed would produce particular kinds of dreams. So, you know, red Leicester causes weird dreams. Brie invokes kind of, you know, celebrities to appear in your dream. This was a survey that was undertaken in Britain, probably as a piece of kind of, you know, wild marketing material.
Right.
But it did speak to a quite long-standing association between the belly and the dreaming mind. The research that I looked into more closely was looking at the way that medieval dream theorists and dream interpreters talked about digestion. And these dream theorists proposed that a number of things could happen. So one, food digesting in your belly could send up vapors to your brain, which would then produce particular kind of dreams or visions. And based on that, they suggested that, you know, dreams that were had in the early part of the morning were more likely to be of a spiritual or kind of divine nature than dreams which were experienced in the early part of the evening, let's say. And the reason for that was that by the early morning, your stomach would have digested all of the food that was in it. There would be nothing sitting there festering anymore.
Right.
And that therefore these kind of your dreams would not be clouded by these like these vapors emitting from the stomach. Now, obviously, we don't tend to think about dreams in exactly those terms anymore. But I think we still sustain some connection between perhaps having, I don't know, overindulged the
yeah.
night before,
yeah.
And then suffering kind of weird nightmares or terrors.
Yeah, I remember when I was a kid, my mother would say, don't eat all that, you're going to have nightmares.
Yes, yeah,
right?
Absolutely.
When you go to sleep, I don't think there's any empirical evidence that's connecting any of these dreams to food, is there?
A folklorist by the name of Caroline Oates has done some research into tracing the cheese dream, but the cheese dream across cultures. So in Britain and North America, we are very likely to report that after eating a strong piece of cheese, we have weird dreams, let's say. Whereas in other countries, namely Southern European countries, so thinking of France, Italy, places like that, people do not tend to report any association between having eaten, you know, a kind of cheese and having a weird dream. And those countries are not known as kind of cheese avoiding nations, right? You know, without postulating exactly what that tells us, I think that it part of what it describes is the way that, yeah, that dreams and the dreaming mind cannot sit outside of culture.
Mm-hmm. Well, in this case, the cheese stands alone, as we used to say. Dr. Richardson, thank you for taking time to be with us today, and good luck with your book.
Thank you so much for having me, Ira. It was a real dream.
Dr. Elsa Richardson, author of Rumbles, The Curious History of the Gut, and she is the co-director of the Center for Social History of Health and Healthcare at Strathclyde University, based in Glasgow, Scotland. We have to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to take a trip to Vermont, where ticks are thriving, in part due to invasive plant species. Want to know about that? Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. And now it's time to check in on the state of science.
This is KERA
for WWNO,
St. Louis Public Radio,
KKB Iowa News. Public Radio News.
Local science stories of national significance. Black-legged ticks, or deer ticks, are a big problem for both people and wildlife in the eastern U.S. Their bites can spread debilitating bacterial infections like Lyme disease, and their populations have spread over the past few decades. Researchers in Vermont and Maine have noticed an interesting correlation between ticks and invasive plant species. A better understanding of this could have an impact on how we manage both. Here's Sci-Fi producer Kathleen Davis with more.
Thanks, Ira. Joining me now to talk about this project is my guest, Lexi Krupp, science and health reporter for Vermont Public, based in Burlington, Vermont. Lexi, welcome to Science Friday.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us about this project that you reported on. What exactly are these researchers in Vermont and Maine trying to figure out?
Just backing up for a minute, there have been a couple studies showing this link between an invasive shrub, Japanese barberry, and black-legged ticks. And if you haven't seen barberry, it's this bush that can grow over your head. It has small leaves that turn red in the fall and bright red berries. It's pretty. A lot of people will plant it in their yards, but in the forest, it can really take over the understory. A while back, researchers in Maine noticed that there were way more black-legged ticks on these plants, twice as many ticks in forests with Japanese barberry compared to nearby forests with native shrubs. Then, a few years ago in Connecticut, other researchers found if you cut down barberry, there's fewer ticks. So this new project that I covered is funded by the National Science Foundation. They have almost $2 million to test this idea out over a longer time period, 5 years. So these researchers are going to experiment with different methods of removing these plants. They're looking at whether you see a reduction in tick numbers nearby in surrounding areas. And they're looking at other invasive species, too. Plants like honeysuckle and common buckthorn that also take over the understory of forests. To see, can we find this connection between ticks and invasive plants as well? Associate Professor Allie Gardner is the project lead. She's a medical entomologist at the University of Maine. And she said at the end of this study, she really wants to be able to give landowners practical advice.
The bottom line is that, you know, we can do all the ecological research we want on the problem, but if we're not actually able to translate our findings into recommendations, you know, ultimately we're not going to make any headway on the problem.
So what's the science behind what these researchers are saying? I mean, why do ticks seem to like these invasive plants?
One thing that might be going on is black-legged ticks like sort of damp environments. They'll actually dry out if they get too much sun. And barberry, and maybe some of these other invasives too, offers this dense, shady habitat where ticks can hang out. Another piece of the story here is the other animals that are part of a tick's life cycle, which is mainly white-footed mice and white-tailed deer. Mice and deer also like to hang out in these areas with plants like barberry and honeysuckle. They offer some protection from predators. And while mice and deer are seeking shelter in these areas, they're also carrying a bunch of ticks.
Hold on. Just let me get some clarity on something. Is it still tick season right now? I was always under the impression that tick season was in spring and summer.
It is still tick season. And this is really confusing because the mosquitoes are gone. It feels like ticks should be gone, too. But that's just not how their biology works. October and November is actually the peak of black-legged tick season in most of the eastern U.S. Where I live in Vermont, this is when there are the most emergency room visits because of tick bites outside of the spring. And I think this is surprising every year because you find very few ticks in August and September. And that's because ticks are around, but they're teeny tiny, basically baby ticks, and they don't bite people and dogs. So it's not until they get to this adult phase later in the fall that they start looking for what's called a blood meal.
So this project that we're talking about, it seems like it could be the perfect solution for two problems, right? Like, you're getting rid of invasive plants to get rid of ticks. But is this too good to be true? I mean, are there skeptics to this idea?
Yeah, I think one issue here is that there are just so many variables when it comes to habitats that ticks like. I spoke to Professor Thomas Mather about this. He's a tick ecologist at the University of Rhode Island and runs this program called Tick Encounter. And he said, you can certainly find ticks in places with invasive species, but there's also lots of ticks in areas without any invasive plants. And he's cautious about this connection between black-legged ticks and an invasive species like barberry.
If you were to look at sort of people's interpretation of those studies, you would think, oh, as soon as you go over to a barberry, instead of those little red berries, they're going to be raining ticks on you. It's not that way.
And he made this point that if you really want to reduce your risk of tick-borne illnesses, there's probably easier ways to do it than removing a bunch of invasive plants. Tick checks are really effective, and so is spraying insecticides that are targeted at ticks.
So what's next for this project?
The research I talked about is starting next year, and they're still figuring out all the details. But the goal is to come out of this with best practices for how to manage invasive plants with the best shot at reducing tick numbers. And I think another goal is to spread awareness of this connection between invasive plants and black-legged ticks. That might give people another reason to manage some of these invasive species on their properties.
Well, that's all the time that we have for now. I'd like to thank my guest, Lexi Krupp, science and health reporter for Vermont Public, based in Burlington, Vermont. Thanks so much for being here.
It was a pleasure.
Archaeopteryx is the earliest bird-like dinosaur that we know of. It lived 150 million years ago, but from then to now, well, researchers don't know much about how the bird brain evolved. There's a gap. But now, an 80-million-year-old bird fossil from the Mesozoic era is helping fill in this gap. It has a remarkably preserved skull, which scientists use to digitally reconstruct the bird's brain. Joining me is a lead author on this study, Dr. Luis Chiappe, paleontologist at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County in California. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Pleased to be here.
Nice to have you. Tell us about this ancient bird. What's its name? Where did it live?
The name is Navaornis hestia. And as you pointed out, it lived 80 million years ago in what is now southern Brazil, not far from the city of São Paulo. It looked very much like a plover, if you want, but it was not at all a plover. It belongs to a group of archaic birds called Enantiornites that were widespread during the Cretaceous period. They lived all around the world. But Navaornis, like other Enantiornites, was a very capable flyer, and it had roughly the size of a plover. And what is surprising of this animal is how much the skull looks like a modern skull, like the skull of a plover.
Wow. So, but is it a direct descendant then?
It is not. I mean, all Enantiornites died out with a mass extinction at the end of the Cretaceous, the same mass extinction that killed dinosaurs like T-Rex and Triceratops 66 million years ago.
So then why is this bird important for you to study?
Two pieces of the story, if you want, are very important. On the one hand, as you pointed out in your introduction, the brain of this animal that we were able to reconstruct falls between Archaeopteryx and that of a modern bird. So it really fills a very long gap that existed before. And on the other hand, what I think is really surprising, and it was unexpected, is that the geometry of the skull of this animal, by that I mean it has a slender bill, It has big eye sockets. It has a vaulted basic cranium. That's where the part of the skull that contains the brain. They look very, very much like that of a modern bird. And yet the bones that made up this skull are primitive. They have primitive features. They're very dinosaurian looking. So in a sense, it's like if you were to be building the Empire State Building with adobe bricks. Yeah, I mean, surprising, right? And unexpected.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
is a great example of what we call convergent evolution. So in this case, Navaornis and modern birds had a common ancestor that is at least 130 million years old. So those lineages have been separated for 130 million years, and yet they converged in having the same geometry of the skull.
That's interesting. As you say, that bird did not survive, but the other birds did.
The modern birds did, of course.
The modern birds did. And so this fossil's lineage, which is extinct, developed similar skull features to modern birds separately.
Exactly.
Wow, that is surprising.
Yeah, and unexpected. And not just similar.
Yeah.
I mean, the similarity is remarkable. You know, I mean, when you look at, say, the skull of an animal, like I'm using a plover because roughly that size, right? Or a pigeon. And you put that skull on one next to the other, unless you're looking into the details of the bones, those skulls look remarkably similar.
Okay, so now that we've met this bird, how did you go about reconstructing its brain?
The way we reconstructed the brain is you use what is called a micro CT, a micro computed tomographer. It's very much like an MRI, right? But much more precise, and it's an X-ray based machine. So you have a bunch of X-ray slices that are very thin of the fossil, and then with software you stitch them all together, and you create a three-dimensional rendering, a three-dimensional image of this skull. And therefore, you could look into the internal portions of this skull without breaking it. And you could reconstruct what is the void of the brain preserved in the fossil. The brain is not preserved anymore, but you could at least reconstruct the void. That's where, you know, you do comparative anatomy, right? And you look at the brain of modern birds and the brain of other animals to be able to identify where the optic lobes are, where the cerebellum is, and so on.
Interesting. So what elements of this fossil then were similar to the earliest birds of those alive today?
Well, what you have, for example, that's most remarkable in terms of the brain is that the brain is rotated. That means that, like in most modern birds, the connection between the brain and the spinal cord comes from the bottom of the skull, not from the back of the skull, the way it does, say, in a typical dinosaur or in Archaeopteryx. So that is an advanced feature that you see, a modern feature that you see in the brain. Nonetheless, when you look at, say, the size of the cerebellum, the size of the other components of the brain, they look more primitive. We were able to reconstruct the inner ear of the bird. And this is important because it's a very critical sensory organ, in particularly for an aerial animal that has to navigate in three dimensions. And the inner ear of Navaornis is also very modern in appearance.
Wow, so there are modern elements in this bird.
Yeah, there's definitely modern elements, and there are also archaic elements, and that's why this is somewhat in between.
You mentioned about how surprising how this bird looked so modern. Did this fossil challenge what you thought you knew about bird brain evolution?
I think it challenged what we knew about the convergent evolution that we see in the shape of this skull. I think that, you know, it also surprises to me, it was surprising to have an inner ear that was so modern looking. I didn't expect that. But what was more unexpected was really the fact that you have this modern-looking skull made up of this very primitive bones. And that was completely unexpected. And, you know, it may be telling you that at the time of constructing a modern avian skull, the skull of a modern bird, you don't have too many ways of putting together a modern avian skull, in that evolution used the tools that it had at the time and built a modern one based on basic bricks.
I mean, does it ever get old studying, you know, creatures that lived millions and millions of years ago?
No. I have done, you know, I've worked on early bird evolution for nearly 40 years. And this one was a mind-blowing discovery, but I'm sure that many others are going to come in the future. I hope to see them.
Where does this rank? Does this make it into the top five fossils of your career?
Definitely. I think so. Undoubtedly.
What number would you put it?
Well, you know, I have found some very cool fossils during my lifetime. And I haven't found this one. You know, it was found by an amateur paleontologist in Brazil. But I think that this is really one of those remarkable fossils. It's the best preserved avian skull in the Mesozoic worldwide. It's just beautifully preserved.
Could we actually see it ourselves at a museum someplace?
It's in Brazil. It's at a museum, a small museum in Brazil, in a city called Marília. But you can see pictures.
We have pictures. Dr. Chiappe, I want to thank you for sharing your knowledge and your discoveries.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me, Ira.
You're welcome. Dr. Luis Chiappe is a paleontologist at the Natural History Museum of Los Angeles County in California. If you'd like to see the fossil and the computer-generated images of the bird brain, go to our website, sciencefriday.com. One more thing before we go. The end of the year is almost here, and we need your help to recap the best science stories from 2024. Tell us your favorite science news stories or discovery from this year. Your submission might even be featured in our recap. Share your thoughts and find out how you can attend our New York City event on December 6th, all on our website, sciencefriday.com/science2024. Lots of folks helped make this show happen this week, including
D. Peterschmidt,
Phyllis Samares,
Emma Gomez,
Jackie Hirschfeld.
Thank you, everybody. BJ Liederman composed our theme music. And of course, if you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts. Have a great weekend. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. A bit later in the hour, we're going to talk about how a little science can help in your cooking and what's living on your toothbrush and shower head. Prepare to be surprised. And speaking of being surprised, when I recently heard of a case of walking pneumonia in a child in my neighborhood, I couldn't believe it. Kids getting pneumonia? Well, I soon found out that across the U.S., there's been an uptick in cases of Mycoplasma pneumonia, walking pneumonia. And yes, it's happening mostly in kids. With Thanksgiving and the holiday season upon us, we're thinking about how to keep you and your family, right? All of us, safe for the holidays. So what do we need to know about this spike of walking pneumonia? Is it something to worry about? What can we do? Joining me to talk about it is Dr. Preeti Sharma, pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Health in Dallas, Texas. She's also an associate professor at UT Southwestern. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. Well, let's start with the basics. Describe what is Mycoplasma pneumonia.
So Mycoplasma is a very common bacteria that's sometimes called atypical. It's not kind of the usual bacteria as we think about that that cause other types of infection. And as you pointed out a moment ago, it's really common, but it's more common in older kids, adults, and we so rarely saw it in younger children that it's not the first thing we think about when kids are sick.
Do you have any reasons why we're seeing a spike in it now and in kids?
That's a great question, because commonly we think of Mycoplasma and walking pneumonia as being present mostly in older kids and adults. I think some of it is because we have an age of children who didn't get exposure to as many illnesses with COVID, many of them were not in group childcare. And so their immune systems are still getting regulated to all the things they're exposed to.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. So let's dive right into this. Give us the ABCs. First, what are the symptoms?
Yeah. So mycoplasma often starts out like a regular cold, sore throat, nasal congestion, sneezing, maybe headache, fevers. And it's one, it looks like one of those colds that just doesn't resolve. And over time, kids start having a cough, and the cough that doesn't seem to get better like you'd expect. Because most people, when they get a respiratory viral illness like a cold, they start improving in about 5 to 7 days. And with many of these cases of mycoplasma, that 7 day mark, parents are still looking at their kids and saying, they're still coughing quite a bit, or they're still having fevers after that time frame. And so that's when that's a good time to have somebody investigate, you know, have a healthcare provider investigate a little bit more and try to see what else might be happening.
Yeah. And so you should go call, that's when you should call the doc, and you should expect that it's spread among kids by droplet infection, breathing on each other?
Yeah. So it's mostly by droplet exposure. So unlike some of the illnesses that are, you know, a casual exposure can lead to illness, it really takes more close contact to acquire mycoplasma. And it has a really long incubation time. So even in families, we'll see one person is sick. And just when you think you're out of the woods because nobody else has gotten sick, the next person will get it because
right.
it can be communicable even 4 weeks after the first person has it.
Wow. And you know what? The first thing people are going to do is say, hey, maybe I'll take a COVID test.
Right.
And that's going to be negative. And then you should investigate.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, the CDC put out a report last month saying that there was a spike across the country, that spike beginning in the spring. How much of an uptick in cases have you seen as a practitioner in Texas?
Yeah. So we started to see an uptick here really more dramatically in the summertime. So late June, July, we started to see more and more cases. And we really thought that at the end of August, we were going to kind of see our peak because kids around here start school mid to late August. And then usually we see things start to decline. And we saw that spike in August, and we've been sort of sustained at that higher level and haven't really started to see a dramatic decrease in cases.
Mm-hmm. And are the cases serious? I mean, is this life-threatening, having this?
So the good news is for the vast majority of kids, it's not anything that needs to be managed outside of the house. In some instances, kids can recover without any antibiotics or any special treatment. But for those kids who do get antibiotics, they recover at home and they recover really well. For those people who have underlying medical problems or lung problems or their immune system is compromised, they may struggle more and require hospitalization or require other medications to help them resolve the infection.
And how common is that for a child to be hospitalized for this?
Fortunately, not very common at all.
Yeah. But it is something to be taken seriously, though.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And what point do you know that you should be seeking help?
So I think when kids are having symptoms past what seems to be the normal recovery period of a viral illness. So most kids have a cold, have those symptoms that we see, will start to improve, you know, in about 5 days. And I think if kids are having fevers for longer than that, or they're feeling under the weather for longer than that, that's a good time to seek attention. But also if earlier in the course, they're really having other difficulties. So if ever, you know, difficulties breathing, chest pain, other symptoms that really seem unusual to parents, right, out of the ordinary, that's a good time.
Right. Good advice. I know you experienced walking pneumonia very similarly, very intimately this year because your daughter had it.
Yeah.
Tell us what that felt like, you being a physician.
It was really unusual because fortunately, you know, she's a pretty healthy kid. She got what looked like a summer cold, some congestion and a little bit of a cough. And when it didn't resolve and it's kind of got to be disruptive. She wasn't sleeping quite as well. And the symptoms just weren't getting better like I expected. That was when I started to think that maybe something was different. And that's when we found out and ended up having to treat her.
Yeah, and I guess people will mistake it for just a common cold if they just think it's running its course, right? But it can get worse.
Absolutely. It can. Exactly.
Yeah, do you do the same things you would do for a cold, like the fluids and things like that?
Absolutely. Those supportive things are really helpful, especially early on. And then for those kids who do have the lingering symptoms or, you know, where it's felt that that's what's happening, that mycoplasma infection is at hand, they recover with antibiotics pretty readily.
And what about telling, you know, the kids' playmates and parents about this? I would think that's pretty important.
It is. And that's a hard one because, you know, our guidelines are that when kids are not having fevers any longer without the use of any medicines to control fever, that they can return to school. And if they feel up to it, they can, you know, return back to their normal activities. But that's sort of where things spread. But it's always wise to let people know that potentially this is what's going on.
Yeah, especially now, right? The holiday season is coming up. There are going to be a lot of gatherings with kids and adults of different generations. Do you have any tips to help people stay safe and prevent the spread of walking pneumonia?
Yeah, the holidays are hard, and that's when we see a lot of viral illnesses or other illnesses kind of spread around. And so if you're attending a gathering and you have symptoms, like, you know, cold symptoms, or you've been sick recently, it's always wise to tell people in case there's somebody who is at higher risk to avoid their exposure. And, you know, lots of hand washing, lots of, you know, teaching kids particular how to cover their cough, but also if it's feasible, wear a mask, because that's going to definitely decrease spread of all kinds of illnesses.
If you're a parent or a caregiver who has a child who you are fearful about going to a meeting that where a kid has had walking pneumonia, should you express that fear and say, you know, I'm just going to be safe and not send my kid to this party?
And I think that's, you know, that depends on the kid and the family and what their circumstances are. You know, certainly if there's somebody in the home who's at higher risk, it's probably reasonable to say, you know, this might be something we have to skip. And it just it depends on their own tolerance of what might happen.
Yeah. You mentioned that COVID-19 is probably a contributing factor to why we're seeing spikes in walking pneumonia now. Have you seen this with other illnesses as a practitioner?
Mm-hmm. In the last couple of years, we've seen kind of very interesting patterns with illnesses. So nothing that we've seen are novel illnesses, right? We've seen mycoplasma and RSV and all these things for ages, but we're seeing them at different times of year and we're seeing them in different amounts. So, you know, the first year that kids were kind of back in normal school, we saw a spike in flu cases and we saw spikes in RSV. So we certainly are seeing it.
Yeah, you know, I can't let you go as a pediatric pulmonologist for children and not ask you questions about other respiratory illnesses that are on your radar this holiday season.
Yeah. You know, COVID is always out there. We tend to see some spikes in cases around the time people gather. So holidays, back to school, those kinds of things. For young infants and people who are vulnerable, we certainly do worry about RSV. So always wise for older adults, vaccinate against RSV. And for young infants, talk to your pediatrician about the antibody shot for RSV protection. And then the other is influenza. Mm. We're headed into the season where we see more and more cases of the flu. And so we always recommend vaccination against the flu to protect yourself and protect your family members.
Now, there's some great words of free medical advice today for our listeners. Dr. Sharma, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Dr. Preeti Sharma, pediatric pulmonologist at Children's Health in Dallas, Texas. She is also an associate professor at UT Southwestern. We have to take a break, and when we come back, a replay of a chat with Chef Jack Bishop about the science of good cooking. timely stuff. You're going to want to hear it.
So I am going to reteach you how to poach an egg, and you're going to be successful.
Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. With Thanksgiving being just a few weeks away, I'm sure you're getting a lot of advice, wanted and unwanted, about cooking for the holiday season. So I'm just going to add a little bit more, because it's been our custom on this show to bring science to the table and the kitchen and offer you helpful suggestions based on cooking chemistry, like the trick to making a perfect dough for that pumpkin or apple pie. I think this one's going to surprise you. Or how to brine your turkey, how to whip up a perfect meringue. Back in 2012, we talked with Jack Bishop from America's Test Kitchen. They just released their book, The Science of Good Cooking. So we turned our studio into our own little test kitchen. And well, here, have a listen. We're cooking in our New York studio. Welcome to Science Friday, Jack.
Hi, Ira. Great to be here.
We are surrounded by cooking stuff.
I know. We don't really, you know, the wires and all the radio things with cooking things. Let's hope it goes well.
Well, let's get right to the first thing. We have a simmering pot of water here. Well, it's not actually a pot, is it?
It's a skillet. So I am going to reteach you how to poach an egg, and you're going to be successful.
I've never done it in a skillet. Usually you take the big pot of water. And that's wrong, you're saying.
The big problem with the saucepan, if you're doing a narrow pot, it's a long way down for the egg to drop into the pot. A lot of people crack it right on the side of the saucepan, and then it falls apart. I mean, the challenge when you're poaching an egg is to keep the white to surround the yolk, so you end up with a set white and a creamy yolk.
All right.
The skillet makes it much easier. So I've got boiling water in a 12-inch skillet. You can use a smaller skillet if you like.
Right.
And the trick here is we're going to gently coax the eggs in. So I've got two teacups, one in each hand. They have little handles on them that allow me to get close to the water. And I've got two eggs cracked into each. And I'm just going to turn them ever so gently into the skillet. Right. I'm going to add a little bit of vinegar. The pH is going to help.
The acidity is going to help.
And a little salt, really, just for flavor. And I'm going to turn off the heat. The other big mistake people make is they boil. And the turbulent water will cause the eggs to break apart.
So you don't want to boil it.
And now I'm going to turn my timer on. And so by using residual heat, you are sort of no churning of the water, so you're not going to blow apart the eggs. And you also get a really consistent result. Because, you know, if you've got a really powerful cooktop, it can be going much sort of faster. We're coming back to the boil. And we're basically just doing it with residual heat. If you were doing it on a real cooktop, we're on a little induction burner.
Right.
You might even slide it off the burner onto a cool burner. We don't have a cool burner. So we're gonna hope this induction burner cools down.
and the vinegar helps coagulate the egg whites? Is that the acid that does that?
We're lowering the pH of the water, and that helps the proteins in the white to sort of unfurl more quickly and bond together and hopefully protect the creamy yolk.
Could you use lemon juice instead?
You could use lemon juice. I just use distilled white vinegar. You don't want to use a colored vinegar, balsamic would give you lightly tinged whites, which may not be that attractive. But, you know, the vinegar will give a little bit of flavor to the eggs, balance a little the richness of the eggs, which is a good thing. So we like that.
Well, while we're waiting for the eggs to cook, let's talk a little bit about more in your book. What is the secret? I read the secret to the perfect pie crust, and it's something I would have never imagined. Tell us what that is.
You know, pie dough seems like it should be simple. It's really just four or five ingredients. Right. You know, there's flour, salt, a little bit of sugar, fat, and ice water. The problem is that most recipes are engineered to use a minimum amount of ice water. And the theory is that when the water is mixed with the flour, you are activating the gluten and you're developing this sort of strand of protein network, which is great if you're making bread. It's what gives bread great chew. But in pie dough, it will make it fairly tough. And so you use as little water as possible in order to just get the flour to sort of hold together with the fat. The problem is most recipes don't use enough. And so you go to roll out the dough and it's cracking. It's really difficult to manage. And most cooks end up adding more water than the recipe says. A typical recipe for a double crust pie will call for 5 or 6 tablespoons of water. But it's really not quite enough. So we said, what is wet that could give us more moisture so that we could hydrate the dough and make it easier to roll out with less cracking, but would not form gluten? And it turns out that alcohol does not form gluten when it's mixed with flour. And so we replaced half of the ice water with chilled vodka in our pie dough.
Do you need a high brand vodka? Do you need a first shelf vodka? Or are you
you're not going to taste it, because what happens is in the oven when you're baking the pie crust, the alcohol is going to cook off. We tested whiskey, rum, tequila.
Party that was, getting testing.
We were testing them, unfortunately, in the pie dough.
I see.
You cannot taste the difference, really, between all of them. The important thing is to use something that's 80 proof. It's 40% alcohol. So that you are, in effect, our recipe calls for 4 tablespoons of water and 4 tablespoons of vodka. But because of the alcohol in the vodka, it's really the equivalent of 6 tablespoons of water, even though you get the sort of rollability of 8 tablespoons of water.
What a trick.
And it seems like it's a really small trick, but it makes it so much easier to roll out the pie dough. And it's really flaky and it's really tender.
So does this come about from actually testing things in the test kitchen, ideas and recipes?
The test kitchen has about 25 people who work full time who are trained cooks. We also have a science editor. And so this was one of those questions that we discussed with our science editor. We said, what's wet that you could add to pie dough that's not going to form gluten? And he said, well, alcohol. And you know, then we went into the kitchen and ran a series of tests.
Right.
Our usual protocols, we'll do sort of one variable tests. And so, you know, we'll do a standard recipe with water, and then we'll do variations, in this case, with vodka. And easy to tell the difference.
So people who have picked up their ears now from hearing this, what's the recipe? How much vodka for how much water?
So in you want to use half water and half vodka. If you have a favorite pie dough recipe that calls for ice water, just replace half of the water with chilled vodka. It's really important that the water is cold so it doesn't melt any of the fat in the dough.
Did you decide that people needed to know more about science in the kitchen?
We really feel like science is the key for many people to finally become a good cook. Mm. You know, I think there's a sort of generational issue that many people didn't grow up in homes where they could watch cooking. And so how do you learn how to cook? And a lot of people get frustrated because they make mistakes and think, oh, I shouldn't be making mistakes.
Right.
Well,
You better.
We're a slave to our timer here. So that means our poached egg. You're going to have to wait for my answer on this one. So I'm going to take the lid off of the skillet.
Right. Ooh, those are gorgeous.
I'm going to now reach in with a slotted spoon to try to take out each of the 4 poached eggs. I'm going to transfer them to a paper towel lined plate. The paper towel is going to soak up the extra water that is still on them. The slotted spoon is getting rid of most of the water, but still some in there. And as you can see, they came out fairly nice.
Thank you. That's great. Very little white left in the water.
Very little white. I think you might want to, at this point, season them with a little bit of pepper.
Oh.
Well, make them taste a little better. And I think, Ira, you have the honor.
Somebody has to take over the show while I eat here.
You at least have to sort of crack
in
and see.
I'm gonna crack one open. This looks good because poached eggs are among my favorite food. I need a little English muffin here, I think.
Yeah, I didn't bring the Canadian bacon and the English muffin. Now, 5 minutes gives you a runny yolk.
That is good. Okay, science. A runny yolk. So if you overcook it, it's going to get a little harder, and 5 minutes works. But the secret, as you said, is not boiling the water, but simmering it.
And the 5-minute works whether you're doing 1 egg or 8. If you're going to do more than 8, you might want to go to 6 or 7 minutes because there's so many eggs in the water. And, of course, if you want a more set yolk, you could go an extra minute. But for a sort of runny yolk, 5 minutes is sort of guaranteed to work.
And eggs are a good place to start if you want to learn about the science of cooking, right? There's so many things you can do with eggs.
It's, you know, they don't call it the incredible egg for nothing because you really can do so many things, not just different cooking methods. You can, you know, scramble it, you can fry it, you can poach it, but it's a key ingredient in so many savory and baked goods.
If you're making scrambled eggs or you're making just plain sunny side ups, is there a perfect temperature that you want? People throw the egg, you know, they heat the skillet up very hot and they throw the egg in and the sizzling. Does that wreck the egg or do you want to cook it on a lower temperature?
For scrambled eggs, the key is fairly high temperature because what you're trying to do is convert the water that's in the eggs. And we also add some half and half to our scrambled eggs.
Oh, you do?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The fat keeps them tender and the additional moisture creates steam, which is what makes them fluffy and light. And so if you're using low temperature for scrambled eggs, if you want really fluffy, light eggs, you're not generating enough steam. So you want fairly high temperature and you have to work really quickly because you don't want them to get tough or brown. For fried egg, we actually heat the pan over low for 10 minutes, trying to get a really even heat, then crank it up so there's no hot spots and add the
should
fried
you use
egg.
A smaller pan, like an omelet pan for one or two eggs, or should you use a bigger pan?
A small pan. It's
a
much
small
better.
Pan.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple of egg lessons. What's the biggest mistake people make with eggs? Is it they use the wrong temperature, or they just...
That they don't add enough fat, usually. In most egg recipes, what you're doing is you're coagulating the proteins. And, you know, if the tendency is to then squeeze out the moisture.
Right.
And if you add a little bit of fat, whether it's a little half and half in your scrambled eggs, mm-hmm. when we make an omelet, we add little cubes of frozen butter to the scrambled, you know, to the eggs that we've sort of beaten by hand, so that there's a little bit of fat in there to ensure a sort of nice soft set that doesn't squeeze out the moisture in the eggs and make them tough.
Cubes of frozen butter in the omelet. I have to remember that because I love to make omelets. There are a lot of great tips in the book, and I want to dive into one in particular, which is the case for brining meat. What is brining meat?
So brining meat is the solution to overcooked lean protein. So we're talking about the white meat in chicken or turkey, lean cuts of pork, like a pork loin or pork tenderloin. There's very little fat. And it can really dry out and be chalky and tough. We've all had a horrible Thanksgiving
right.
turkey.
Yes.
The solution next year is to brine the turkey. And you are putting the protein in a bucket with a solution of salt and water. And what is happening is that the salt is changing the structure of the muscle fibers and creating spaces that can then trap the natural juices in meat. Most meat is 75% water. And the goal is to preserve that natural moisture. And by changing the shape of the proteins, it's actually the sodium and chloride ions have negative and positive charges, and they're changing the way the mosaic of charges on the proteins are working, and you are getting more water to be held into the meat, its own natural juices, in addition to obviously some of the water that's in the brine makes its way into the meat. And basically, we found in side-by-side tests, you can cut moisture loss by 25%.
Wow.
Which is a really
doesn't
significant...
Doesn't taste salty, the meat, when you take it out?
You don't want to season it too much. The average amount of salt, if you brine it, is going to be about an eighth of a teaspoon per serving. So it's about the same if you buy a kosher chicken or
right.
if you buy a butterball turkey, which has been injected with salt.
Right.
You wouldn't brine those because they already have about right. that level
right.
of salt
yeah.
in them.
All right. We have another wonderful in-studio demonstration that we're going to talk about. What have you got here? I'll let you explain it.
I have two identical bowls, two identical whisks. Inside each bowl are three egg whites. Now,
right.
whipped egg whites are the secret to everything from souffles to cakes. We are going to both take a bowl and start whisking and see who can make better progress.
Come on.
Now, I know you're going to say...
I used to be good at this, but this is not working.
Well, so what we're doing is we're creating a foam here. And as you can see in my bowl, I'm already...
I got nothing.
Yeah, you got nothing. I actually kind of did something not very nice to your bowl. I sprayed it with a little bit of Pam cooking spray.
And dirty rat.
Yeah. The fat is... The point here is that if you get even a teeny bit of fat, and that fat can be leftover grease from not washing the bowl very well, to the fat from the yolk, it will prevent those whites from whipping properly. And you really can't get a stable foam.
No, I was really surprised because I'm pretty good at making meringue sort of thing. Or if I make an omelet, I make the egg yolk separate than the whites and put them back together. Nothing.
And so, you know, it's a really delicate operation. You are taking, you know, a couple of tablespoons of liquid whites and a lot of sort of horsepower in your
right.
arm and turning this into a stable foam. And if there's a little bit of fat in there, it will cause the foam to collapse or really even just prevent the foam from forming.
So you want to make sure then it's a very clean bowl and you haven't put butter or something in it beforehand.
And never use plastic. It's almost impossible to
right?
get a plastic bowl really clean. There's always traces of fat in plastic. So I had stainless steel bowls here. Glass is fine, but avoid plastic because it just doesn't really get as clean as it should.
What about the temperature of the bowl? Or I mean, I've heard people say you may have a cold bowl or the egg yolk should the white should be cold. What's with that?
It is much easier to separate the yolks when they're cold because the yolks are much firmer and taut and the eggs will not separate. So separate the eggs right from the refrigerator. In terms of the whipping, whether those whites are at room temperature or cold isn't going to make much difference in the ability to create a foam.
Are there any new techniques based on science? I've heard people using vacuuming. They vacuum pack the food before they cook it.
Yeah, I mean, it's a really interesting time in food because in the world of professional cooking, in restaurants, there's so much science and technology. I mean, molecular gastronomy is really changing the way that a lot of chefs prepare dishes in restaurants. At home, the technology is kind of the same old technology. You know, the microwave sort of came and went, and people use a microwave to, you know, warm coffee, but they don't really cook in a microwave. And so the technology, even though, you know, we spend a lot more on the equipment than we used to in our kitchen, it really is basically the same equipment with nicer finishes.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about the different type of cooking oils. There are so many different ones. What's the science behind which type of oils to use for what purposes?
So the first thing you want to think about is, are you going to be heating the oil? And if you're heating the oil, then the smoke point is hugely important. And in that case, you want an oil with a high smoke point, because once the oil starts smoking, it's a sign that it's breaking down and degrading. And so olive oil, for instance, has great flavor, but because it's not fully refined, it has a fairly low smoke point. It's not really great for frying or sautéing. Vegetable oils, soybean oil, corn oil, canola oil, those can withstand more heat.
But all of Italian cookery is based on using olive oil, isn't
it?
Well,
it's long. I mean, for yes, most of that olive oil that, I mean, my Italian grandmother would sauté in it, but she was using refined olive oil. And so, you know, if you've got a really high-end extra virgin oil that's got particulate matter in it, you don't want to be frying in it because that means it's going to smoke at a much lower temperature.
So you use a worse grade of oil than to fry in it?
Well, if you're going to be cooking, yes. You know, for salad, I wouldn't use anything other than really good extra virgin olive oil. But for cooking, we use a lot of vegetable oil. In
peanut
the
oil?
Kitchen.
Peanut oil?
Peanut
is good.
Oil has a great high smoke temperature. It has a sort of nice flavor that can add. Most of the flavors are really subtle. So the difference between corn and safflower and sunflower and canola are really very minor. The one thing is, we don't like to fry in canola oil. We find that it gets a little fishy tasting, actually, when it's heated for really long periods of time when you're frying. So we don't fry in canola oil.
Is there one oil healthier, the unsaturated oils?
Olive oil is probably, you know, and the canola oil get the best marks from the nutritionists. You know, I think we like olive oil except for super high heat applications.
Jack Bishop, chef and senior content advisor at America's Test Kitchen. He cooked with us in studio back in 2012 when they released their book, The Science of Good Cooking. And if you like those tips, we're going to have some more for you. Next week, as you get ready for your big holiday meals, we'll have more fun food science. After the break, searching for new bacteriophages in the dark depths of your bathroom. Stay with us. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. If you've been listening to this program for a while, you know that one of my favorite topics is the bacteriophage, tiny viruses that specialize in hunting down bacteria. There were big efforts in the former Soviet Union to develop phages as antibiotics around 100 years ago, but the approach really didn't catch on here, overshadowed by the rise of conventional antibiotics like penicillin. But the phages themselves are still out there and might one day help treat disease. Writing recently in the journal Frontiers in Microbiomes, researchers report that they have found a whole host of phages that had never been seen before. And where were they? They were lurking in plain sight on things like your toothbrush, your showerhead. Joining me to talk about it is Dr. Erica Hartman, an associate professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, these are not something people should be scared of, right?
No, absolutely. Bacteriophage are viruses that infect bacteria. They absolutely do not infect people. And while we are very interested in microbes from a human exposure standpoint, we have no reason to think that any of these will actually make anyone sick.
Okay, that's good. Good to start through.
Yeah.
Let's go through your study. You had people send in samples taken from their bathrooms. Why that place in particular?
Yeah, so we're really interested in built environments, you know, our homes, our offices, those kinds of things, for a couple of reasons. One is that it's where we, you know, in the developed world, we spend most of our time. If you just think about, you know, the course of your day, you spend not so much of it outside. And so this is a really important environment for us in general. And then it's also an interesting environment because it's engineered. It's an environment where we can sort of manipulate parameters. We can change it. And in so doing, we might be able to change our microbial exposures. So that's one of the reasons we're interested in the built environment in general. And then specifically these samples. So they're from shower heads and toothbrushes. And so one of the things that's really important for microbes in terms of being able to survive is the presence of water. And shower heads and toothbrushes are two locations within the bathroom where we thought it would be really interesting to just see who's there.
Mm. And once you collected them, you used genetic tools to separate the various virus types in the samples, right?
Yes. So we had extracted DNA from these samples. So we're only looking at DNA-based microbes, and we wanted to see what types of bacteria were there and then what types of bacteriophage that might be associated with them.
And what did you find?
So on the one hand, we found a bunch of things that we don't really know what to do with, a bunch of viruses that we can't really say that much about, except that we can infer that they're there. And that's not terribly surprising in one sense, because we just know so little about bacteriophage and there are so many of them out there. It was surprising to me, though, just to see how different every like two samples were. So I didn't necessarily expect toothbrushes and showerheads to look similar, but I sort of thought that maybe there would be more similarities between individual toothbrushes or between individual showerheads. And it turns out that there are just a ton of new and different viruses in each sample.
So one sample from another person, they're totally different in the viruses that are there.
Yeah, more different in the viruses that are there than in the bacteria that are there.
Ah. Well, that's an interesting thing, because if a phage hunts bacteria, usually it's a one-on-one thing, isn't it? One phage for one kind of bacteria. But you're sort of saying that these could be like broad-spectrum viruses, if I hear you correctly.
So I don't know, and I think this is all speculative. This is all hypothetical here. But one of the things that I suspect is happening is that the way we have studied bacteriophage in the past, you know, you talked about in Eastern Europe 100 years ago, those methods that they were using 100 years ago are still the methods that have, you know, sort of dominated the way we study phage for the last 100 years. So we have these sort of assumptions about how phage work and what they're like. You know, there are trillions of phage out there, and I think it's hard to make any sort of general statements about anything with trillions of instances of diversity. So on the one hand, I don't know that it's necessarily one phage, one bacterium, and it could be actually that even though we're seeing the same bacteria in a lot of places, we see different phage that infect them. So it's more like one bacterium, tens or hundreds of thousands of phage. It's also possible that there are some phage that can go between different bacterial species, and we just haven't been using the right methods to detect them.
And that would be good news, wouldn't it? If you're trying to develop possibly medicine from the phages, so it might attack many different kind of bacteria.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of interest in sort of broad or broader spectrum phage for various reasons. Just from a fundamental biology perspective, understanding what exactly limits or allows phage to infect different hosts is super interesting. And if we can understand how that works, then we could certainly use that to design phage for various applications, including therapeutics.
Where did the bacteria and the phages come from? Did we leave them behind taking a shower or on our toothbrushes?
Yeah. So unless you're doing something different than I am in the shower, I don't like interact with my shower head that much. And so we suspect that most of the bacteria that are there are actually coming from the water and the sort of premise plumbing system itself. So that's sort of a one-way street of like things coming onto you. Whereas with your toothbrush, you know, obviously you're putting that in your mouth. You are definitely depositing a lot of different bacteria onto your toothbrush. But there's also on your toothbrush an opportunity for bacteria from like the air in your bathroom or the water from your faucet or on your skin, because you're also holding your toothbrush. So lots of different ways for organisms to get to your toothbrush.
Right.
And so one of the things that I think is super interesting is exactly looking at that biogeography of indoor environments and trying to understand where these bugs come from and where they wind up.
Well, I hate to remind people of the study that showed the spray from the toilet creating a mist in your bathroom also.
So one of the original reasons that we were looking at toothbrushes, and the first thing that we did with these samples before we even looked at phage, was to look at bacteria. And in part, we were really curious about that. You know, are there actually toilet aerosols and toilet associated bacteria that are on your toothbrush? And overwhelmingly, what we see is that the bacteria on your toothbrush come from your mouth. So it's I wouldn't be too concerned about it.
Okay. Yeah, because that's been a big story over the years. Are there any similarities in the samples you see, like are rural ones different from city ones, or ones from the south different from the north or the west?
So I think our toothbrush study was sort of underpowered to look at that. The toothbrushes really only came from the Chicago area because that was sort of a small pilot study. From the showerhead samples, the biggest difference that we saw was whether the water came from a well or a municipal system. And that sort of makes sense because they're really different ways of, you know, getting and treating and distributing water, which again goes back to this thought of the built environment is a collection of systems that we can uniquely modify and tune. So if there are maybe specific things that we're interested in by thinking about water source and thinking about water distribution systems, we could potentially change them.
Right, right. Now, once you get the phages, how do you figure out what the phages are doing? I mean, do you have to culture them somehow?
So 100 years ago, you would have to culture them.
But now we're in the age of DNA, right?
We're in the age of DNA. So what we did, again, we just took DNA from these samples and using sort of sequencing and bioinformatics, so just trying to like interpret that sequencing data, we tried to figure out essentially who those phage would have infected and what types of functions they're carrying. But we actually couldn't figure out what most of those putative functional genes or what those functions are.
Right.
So we can infer a lot just by having the DNA sequence, but there are obvious limitations to that. And one of the things I'm really hoping to do going forward is to expand our toolkit for being able to study phage so that we're not limited to asking questions the same way as they did 100 years ago. And we can actually, you know, expand the types of phage we can study. By some estimates, only 1% of bacteria can be cultured. And if you think that there are maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of phage that infect each bacteria, if you've only got 1% of the hosts, you've only got a teeny tiny fraction of the bacteriophage.
Right. Do you think the Soviets then were on the right track back then, of looking for antibiotics this way?
So there are a few things. One is there are billions and trillions of bacteria out there, and they evolve much faster than we do. They have much shorter lifespans and an enormous amount of diversity to sort of sample from. So when we're trying to think about getting bacteria to do what we want them to do, so in this case, curing an infection, I don't think there's a one-size-fits-all approach because there's this enormous amount of diversity and this enormous potential to evolve. So I don't think there is a, like, quote-unquote singular right approach. I think probably the best thing to do is to have a variety of tools that are based in a variety of systems. And so I think there's a lot of promise for phage-based control. I think there's a lot of promise for phage and antibiotic combination therapies. It's not a question that we're going to answer and move on from. It's something that is going to require constant sort of monitoring and surveillance and creativity so that we can continue to be able to save lives and protect public health.
But would you say that there is now a renewed interest in phages?
Oh, 100%. Yeah, it's a renewed interest and it's absolutely justified because the approach that we've taken, the antibiotic drugs, is no longer working. It's, I think, motivating a lot of people to be very interested in phage therapies, which is great, but it's also driving a lot of the tool development and a lot of the sort of sampling efforts to understand these organisms better, which I think is also great.
Mm-hmm. Do you think you can make synthetic designer phage?
I mean, we're working on it.
You or just in general?
Me and in general. So I think there's a lot of challenges to engineering phage. We're getting pretty good at it. We, the scientific community, I should say, is getting pretty good at it for certain well-studied phage in certain well-studied organisms. We've used certain elements of phage in molecular biology as like research tools for quite some time. But again, there's this enormous amount of untapped diversity. And so we really need to develop new tools to be able to understand and then manipulate that untapped diversity. And that's one of the things that I personally am really excited about.
And is that how this study fits in with the designing of phages? Do you collect them just to collect more parts and see what's useful?
That's one element of it for sure. So I think before going in and really messing with a system, it can help to understand just how it works and what the basic parameters are that you're starting with. And so part of what we're doing is just cataloging things out of general curiosity and trying to figure out what's out there and how it works and, you know, what really does determine the types of microbes that you find on your toothbrush. But then one of the possible implications from that is exactly having this catalog of functions and parts and things that we might be interested in later when we are getting to the point of engineering.
Yeah. You know, I always have a blank check question I give to my guests, which is if I had a blank check right here in my back pocket and I was going to give it to you to make, create, or use somehow in your research or to advance the field somehow, what would you do with it? And I guess I'm asking you, where should the money be spent now these days on this research?
I mean, it's such a good question. It's such an open field right now because there's so much to be learned that I think there are a million different directions you could go with it. I think the method development in particular is really interesting because the better our tools get, the better our methods get, the more interesting questions we can ask.
Let me stop you and ask you, what do you mean by method development? We lay people don't get that lingo there.
Yeah. So 100 years ago, the way you would have studied phage is you would have gotten a petri dish and you would have grown bacteria on it. And then you would have added some whatever, like pond water, and looked for what we call plaques, which are holes where the phage have infected the bacteria and killed them. And so it creates a little clearing zone, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that was sort of that, you know, you can use that, you can use microscopy, and you can try to figure out what these things are. But it's a very, very limited tool set in terms of being able to really understand all of the different components and really how they work. And now we've advanced with molecular biology. We can do things like DNA sequencing, so we can figure out what the genome sequence of these things are. We have better microscopes. We can see all of the different crazy forms and shapes that they take. We have new and exciting methods for figuring out how a bacteriophage attaches to a cell and like recognizes a host. Once it gets into the host, how it hijacks the host cellular machinery to replicate itself, what its life cycle is, how it might change over the life cycle, and what all of the different components are within that process. And really, like those molecular tools, being able to understand step by step what's happening. That's what I'm talking about with method development, is really being able to see, not just like, ooh, look, I grew something on a plate, but like, I grew something on a plate. It has 50 different genes, and I can tell you what each of those genes do.
So you don't have any one pet tool or technique you wish were developed better that you would like, you would use your money for?
You know, it's funny. When I first started in research, I was really excited about something called proteomics, which is this way of studying basically all of the proteins that are present in a cell. And I did that for like 10 years and I really loved it. But ultimately, I got to this point in my career where I had to make a decision of like, do I keep doing this and get like deeper and deeper into this particular method? Or do I sort of jump fields and expand my toolkit? And I ended up jumping fields. And in my lab specifically, we don't necessarily specialize in any one particular method. And part of that is because I want to be able to answer questions from, you know, whatever viewpoint is the appropriate one, and being able right. to use a full toolkit and be able to really like figure out what's the most appropriate way to answer a question, I think is really exciting. So again, for the field in general, I would not say like, oh, there's one thing that will allow us to like completely change everything. I think it's a bunch of different things that will all come together that, you know, it's all of the different hands on the elephant kind of thing that will allow us to see gotcha. All of the different parts and then how they work together.
I don't think I'll be looking at my toothbrush quite the same way now, although not out of fear.
The point that I always try to hammer home is that even though we're thinking about developing therapeutics, and even though we're thinking often about fighting infections, that the vast majority of bacteria out there are not harmful and possibly even good. So we need bacteria on our skin and in our gut and all of those things to actually keep us like happy and healthy and functional. And we need bacteria in the world to cycle oxygen and carbon and nitrogen. So the amount of microbial diversity out there isn't a bad thing. It's a great thing. It's wonderful. And we should promote that.
Well, Dr. Hartmann, I want to thank you for taking time to bring us up to date on one of my favorite subjects, bacteriophages.
Thank you so much.
Dr. Erica Hartmann, Associate Professor in the Department of Civil and Environmental Engineering at Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. And that about wraps up this week. If you missed any part of the program or you would like to hear it again, subscribe to our podcasts or ask your smart speaker to play Science Friday. Or check out our newsletters. Yeah, sciencefriday.com/newsletters. Lots of interesting stuff in there, too. And you can always reach us the classic way, our email, scifry@sciencefriday.com. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatow.